You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. This is The Bike Show. My name's Jack Thurston. And joining me in the studio today is David Ferry, an artist, art teacher down at Winchester School of Art, and more importantly, today at least, a cycling fiend, a road racing legend, a time trial champion. And we'll be talking to him about cycling, about art, about where cycling meets art, and about where cycling departs from art. David, welcome to the show.
Hello.
So how did you first get into cycling?
Well, I remember the first cycle I ever had, which was a tiny little thing with stabilisers on, which I couldn't ride at all. And I had this dream one evening that I could ride it. And I got up the next morning and whisked the stabilisers off, and I rode it straight away, straight through the garage doors and down the road. And my parents were extremely concerned about this because I basically disappeared. I came back eventually, of course.
And then how you got in your teenage years into some serious bike riding. How did that happen?
Yeah, my father actually bought me my first real racing bike. He had a bit of success on the horses, knew that I was madly into cycling, and bought me this great machine. This was at 14. And I joined a Northwestern road club, which is called the Cleveleys Road Club, a very famous club in near Blackpool, which was where I was born, and basically started to go out into an area of Lancashire called the Trough of Bowland. So it was from the city to the hills, really, an escape.
And what was it about getting out into the hills that appealed to you at that time of your life?
A curious sense of achievement, and also being untethered from either parental or school care, I guess.
And what kind of rides? How long would you be riding?
I'd be riding probably 5-6 hours a day with guys double my age, older. I remember one day being out on a particularly fierce climb, which features in the used to feature in the Tour of Britain, called Harris End, and basically being stationary because I was balanced between the fear of falling off and not having the strength in the legs to go forward. That was a kind of interesting entree into the world of hill climbs.
And there was something about getting out from life on a dull day, and
well,
there's something liberating about cycling.
There certainly
isn't there?
Is, particularly coming from a seaside town called Blackpool, which out of season is really very, very grimy and greasy indeed. Something to do with the inclement weather, the dirtiness of the sea, that brown grey sea, and a kind of major sense of absolute pitiful boredom at not being able to get out into landscape.
And when you got on your bike and hit the hills, you felt different?
Liberated. Absolutely liberated.
And there's a song that you brought along.
Oh, yes.
That you think this brings this to mind.
This is a corker. This is a song by Morrissey. You'll all know it. But it's basically, it's been written as being about Blackpool out of season.
Oh,
Every day is like Sunday, summing up what David Ferry, who's joining me in the studio today on the bike show, was escaping from. David, how did cycling and your involvement in art develop in your teenage years and into your 20s?
A dilemma between wanting to take cycling extremely seriously, having absolutely no academic output by dint of flunking school, basically, and wondering what on earth I would do in life. By another level of chance, I went to the local foundation course at Blackpool College of Technology and was taken on. So basically, ever since, I've relayed what is basically a kind of dual system of existence, making art and being on the bike. And at they come together.
Yeah, how do they come together?
They come together philosophically, I think. You can't obviously draw or take pictures when you're on the bike. I've tried to take little photographs when I've been on it. But basically, it's a philosophical statement about being liberated and free and looking at things from a sideways on angle, a kind of lateral view of Britain, if you like.
And so for the people who don't know your work, if you can give a kind of description of the kind of things that you do.
OK, I'll just read you a little bit that was written for a catalogue a couple of years ago by the art historian Brandon Taylor. And it goes on to say, "One is seldom completely sure whether Ferry's purpose is to follow Penrose and the English surrealists in uncovering a series of mysteries at the heart of the English rural scene, or whether he is intent on ruining, by systematic degradation and debasement, the hallowed seriousness of the vocabulary of very deep England and its historically contingent moral order."
So for listeners, you do a lot of montage.
Yes, humorous.
And so humorous montage where you're taking, an old tourist guide of rural England and adding things to it that are a bit out of place.
I stick things in, rather like Joe Orton and Kenneth Halliwell, who went to prison famously many decades ago for doing the same in public libraries. A fantastic maxim, really, for I suppose what is a collagist defilement mentality.
So what kind of things might you drop into the rural landscape?
Things that may be found in the city, you know, wheelie bins with mountain bikers flying over them in the hallowed seriousness of Ainsford, crossing the little bridge there, or effectively surrealist incidents that jar and disturb the context of what is usually known as a fact.
And there's something about riding through the countryside when you're in the countryside or in small towns. Things are passing by you very quickly. You've got this almost cinematic experience.
Indeed. And they're then frozen in time in your brain, because unlike a car journey where you basically sleep most of the time, unless you're driving, of course, things bypass you and you don't really take care. But on a bicycle, you are in the element. You are, in a sense, in the real film of that time. And rather like any edit system, you can download material from the brain and replay it later.
And you've got a bit of Matt Seaton's book, The Escape Artist, about life on the road and what it's like to be a road racer, that you're going to read out now.
This is about it starts with the scary business of descending at speed. Descending demands skill and courage and a lack of imagination. To imagine too much is to wake up in the middle of the night sweating, jerked awake by the thought of what might happen if you fall. The Italian racer Gianni Bugno, twice world champion in the late 80s, once joked that when his confidence was at its lowest, he had become so fearful of descending that he would ride down mountains like a priest in a cassock. To descend like that, with your hands grabbing the brakes all the way, unable to believe that the next hairpin can be negotiated at anything more than walking pace, is not an option for the professional cyclist. Bugno's cure was to listen to Mozart on headphones as he rode down the mountain. The music blocked his fear, soothed his brain, and allowed him to trust in his reflexes with the magic flute he learnt to fly once more.
Well, that's from Matt Seaton's book, The Escape Artist, A View of Life from the Saddle. So do you prefer going up hills or going down them, David?
Going up them.
Really?
But I also like going down them. But in some big races, in some of the big amateur events I've been in, Unfortunately, you have to be very careful of other people. It's slightly easier going up because you're not going that fast, but coming down hairpins in the Pyrenees or the Alps at anything up to about 70k can mean serious hospitalisation if you hit something.
Well, one of the great, all-time great British riders, of course, is Tom Simpson, famous for triumphs on the continent. And we have a short recording here of the commentary of when he was about to win the Cycling World Championship.
People are cheering and shouting. Everything is complete excitement in typical continental fashion. And this greatest possible moment in British cycling, because Tom Simpson must at least be second, and no Englishman has ever been nearer than fourth, and that was Simpson himself last year, and Tom is leading at the moment. Simpson, I can see now down the road, way down the road, I can see them coming up. A tremendous effort between the two. They're side by side. Simpson in the blue jersey with the red sleeves for England, and Altig is on his wheel. They're on the near side of the road, and they are going for the line like mad, and Simpson, I think, is going to do it. Simpson is away, he's clear. Simpson has won the world championship, the first time ever by a Great Britain rider.
One of the great heroes for anybody who's ever done any serious road racing in this country. Of course, Tom Simpson came to a sticky end on Mount Ventoux. Overexertion, dehydration, probably a bit of amphetamines, brandy was said to be what they found in his body after he died. And there's now a memorial, of course, on that hill, which you have cycled past. Tell us about your ride up Mont Ventoux.
Well, I've done it a few times. The first time I rode it, I was completely solo. The second time in a race. The first time I went past the memorial, got an incredible lump in the throat, actually. It is quite a profound statement. Partly because of your own exhaustion at that time after what can be anything up to an hour and a half of solid out of the saddle climbing, you suddenly get to this effectively awesome monument of somebody else's trials and tribulations, and it actually is an extremely profound moment. The last time I raced up it was during the 2000 version of the Tour in France.
I mean, that's the day when lots of amateur riders can follow in the footsteps of the greats.
Absolutely. It's basically a stage of the Pro Tour. In fact, that went up the day after.
So you go up in a great crowd of people. About how many people?
Oh, there was, in terms of racers that day, there was probably about 7,500. It's a large timed event. There was literally tens of thousands of supporters and people from that area of France. Full support, medics and whatever, but we came across pitiful weather. My group got through, but I think less than a third of riders that day actually made it to the summit, which was actually the finish of the stage as well.
Why didn't they make it?
It was hailstoning, almost the size of ping pong balls, sub-zero temperatures, although this was obviously in July, remarkable.
So it's because you're up a mountain, essentially.
You're about... it's a seriously high mountain, that one. And the race commissionaires pulled a stop on it before people basically died of exposure.
And one person did die that year.
Unfortunately, yes. Of exhaustion and exposure, a kind of dual attack on the system, as it were. And as I said, about nearly two-thirds of the field were held back, but I was fortunate to get through and got a medal.
So what goes through your mind when you're being pelted by hailstones, when your legs feel that they can't go on anymore? What is it in your brain that is happening that makes you keep going and not just pull over to the side and give up because you just can't go on anymore?
So an obstinate nature that will not take no easily. In Paul Kimmage's book, A Rough Ride, he accounts a tale not dissimilar to my own in the 1989 Giro d'Italia, and he goes on to say, "How do I explain today, a day quite unlike any other that I have known in 16 years? Looking back, it seems so unreal. The 130-kilometre stage from Misuria to Kovara was one of the shortest of the race, but with five mountains to be climbed, it promised to be one of the hardest. It was. We approached the Mammalada, the third and hardest of the climbs. I am part of a 40-man group, already 10 minutes behind the leading riders. It has rained since the start. I looked towards the summit, but it was hidden, hidden in a mass of angry jet-black cloud. A huge crack of thunder warns us of the dangers to come, but we climb. The cold rain turning to sleet, and then 3 kilometres from the summit to snow. Hundreds of spectators leave the warmth of their cars to encourage us. 2,000 metres above sea level, I stop to take out the plastic jacket from my pocket. A group of fans surround me, one sheltering from the falling snow flakes with his umbrella. Another offers me a sheet of newspaper, which I place under my jersey. And then I set off, the cheers warming me as I go to face my Calvary. You see, climbing a mountain in snow is not really a problem. With your heart tapping at 175 beats a minute, the body generates enough heat to fend off the worst of the weather. The trouble starts when you go down the other side. There is no physical effort involved here, just the mental concentration of braking and turning. The heart rate drops and the body no longer produces heat, and within minutes you are sweating, not shivering. The snow was falling at such a rate that it started to clog up the teeth of my back wheel, making the chain jump. It was difficult to see, and our group had now disintegrated as we descended one by one, every man for himself. I crossed the finishing line 33 minutes after stage winner Flavio Giapponi. We drove to the hotel, and once there, there was no hot water. Well, I mean, after a day like that, how could you expect there to be hot water? I didn't care. I just covered my filthy legs with a tracksuit bottom and climbed into bed. I turned to my teammate, and said, "Don't bother waking me for dinner. Just wake me in the morning and put me back on my bike." Tonight I am happy. 10 riders abandoned. 20 others were outside the time limit, but were excused because of the deplorable weather conditions. I survived. The cannibal.
Well, that's an account of a particularly hard ride in the Giro d'Italia by Paul Kimmage in his book Rough Ride. So, David, you seem to be drawn to the hard side of cycling. I mean, on this show, we're trying to include people to get people out on their bikes to enjoy the fun of cycling. But for you, is it about pain exclusively?
No, it's about actually coming to terms with yourself as a human being, to be liberated enough to say, well, I might come last today, but I'm kind of damn well going to finish. And basically, the more you train, the more you race, the more exciting the concept of getting on the bike becomes. I started out, as I said, as a 14-year-old. I was encouraged by older guys in the team, and anybody wanting to join a cycling club, there will always be people there who will help, cajole you into actually doing more than you can expect yourself. Once that realisation has hit the brain, you just basically go out and do it.
And where is a good place for people to go in and around London?
Basically, there are a plethora of cycle teams and clubs in the London area. Any website with a keyword of cycling clubs.
LondonCycleSport.com is...
Absolutely.
Or is it londoncyclesport.co.uk? Anyway, London Cycle Sport runs a website.
Indeed, and they will have links then to all the major London teams, and there are quite a lot.
And they'll be welcoming to people who maybe somebody does a lot of commuting but has never really done any serious riding.
Absolutely, they'll take them out into the countryside, and basically that's where that liberation process begins.
And you've brought another record along by the Jesus and Mary Chain, and this is one of your favourite riding tunes.
It is, it's a roadrunner of a track.
Darkest feeling, give it up, come on.
Happy When It Rains by the Jesus and Mary Chain, one of David Ferry's picks as a great cycling song. You're listening to The Bike Show on Resonance 104.4 FM, and in the studio is joining me is David Ferry. David, your next show.
Yes, the next show actually opens on 1st of March at the Chelsea Arts Club. It'll be a series of images relating to English history. I've taken a book and defiled it in the way that we mentioned on the programme earlier. I stick photographs in where they shouldn't be and then reproduce them as lithographic prints. So they'll be on view for 1 month from the 1st of March onwards.
And that's at the Chelsea Arts Club?
Chelsea Arts Club off the King's Road, Old Church Street.
And so when have you last been for a great bike ride and what was so great about it?
I think the last big ride I did was the South African tour of the Cape, called the Cape Argus, after the main sponsor, the Argos newspaper in Cape Town. That was at the time, that March of last year, 2004, the largest recorded timed event in terms of participation in the world. There were 35,000 riders. Obviously, there is a seeding process. The race has a professional content and then an international section. I was in the international section, which was about 800 and something strong, and I made 70th that day, so I was quite pleased with
that's
the ride.
That's pretty good. And did you get out at all over the Christmas break?
No, I didn't. I went up to the north of England, where I came from those early cycling days, and it was covered in snow. So not having a mountain bike with me, it was impossible.
Well, thanks very much for coming on the show and sharing your experiences. We'll have to get you on again. I'll maybe go out for a ride with you and we'll do one of our outside broadcasts. Next week, joining me in the studio will be Jeremy Deller, recent winner of the Turner Prize, who created a whole storm of attention to cycling when he dedicated his victory in the prize to everybody who cycles in London. So tune in again at the same time, 1:30 until 2 for the bike show. And playing us out now is the Psychedelic Furs, another final choice of David Ferry, All That Money Wants. Getting louder, drowning in the
Join us for a live You Are Here.